From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Poet Sekou Sundiata is one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. On today's Fresh Air, he performs an excerpt of his new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, about the year he had kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. Later that year, he was driving through the snow to his comeback performance when his car slid off the road and he broke his neck. Blessing the Boats is about no longer being the self you thought yourself to be. It premieres Friday in Manhattan. We'll also hear from the woman who donated her kidney to Sundiata, Katia Stitt. She's his manager and good friend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In a speech in Prague today, President Bush said that the NATO alliance must adapt if it's to meet new threats such as those posed by global terrorism and by Iraq. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Prague.
The president was speaking to a gathering of European students in advance of the two-day NATO summit taking place here. Mr. Bush said that NATO needs to redefine itself to remain relevant. Today's threats, he said, require an organization that can react quickly to crisis around the world.
The United States proposes the creation of a NATO response force that will bring together well-equipped, highly ready air, ground, and sea forces from NATO allies, old and new. This force will be prepared to deploy on short notice wherever it is needed.
On Iraq, the president said if Saddam Hussein again denies having weapons of mass destruction, then he, quote, will have entered his final stage as leader. Don Gagne, NPR News, with the president in Prague.
As they prepare to adjourn, congressional leaders have failed to reach agreement on extending unemployment benefits. The latest extension of benefits will run out at the end of December, leaving at least 820,000 jobless Americans without benefits. The Democratic-led Senate has passed a measure that would extend unemployment benefits for another 3 months. The version passed by the Republican-controlled House would extend benefits for another 5 weeks, but it contains unrelated provisions that the Senate didn't like. The Senate is adjourning today, but the House could still take up the issue if it holds another session on Friday. The Pentagon is defending an experimental plan for a national database to use against terrorism. Critics have said the project could amount to a giant domestic spying effort. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
The project, going by the somewhat Orwellian name, Total Information Awareness, will test the feasibility of putting together a database that might help alert investigators to planned terrorist activity. Pete Aldridge, the Pentagon's technology chief, says the idea is to be able to identify routine transactions, getting a driver's license, making a phone call, buying a gun, and then using computer technology to draw a connection to suspicious acts or events.
You're looking for trends and transactions that are associated with some potential terrorist act. That's what you're looking for, and you're trying to put those pieces together.
Aldridge emphasized that the Total Information Awareness Project is experimental to see whether an effort like this is even feasible. He says the initial work will involve only fabricated data, and no one's privacy rights should be jeopardized. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 148 points to close at 8,623 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 45 points, or 3.3%. It closed at 1,419. This is NPR News. There's been some progress in settling thousands of lawsuits brought by Canadian Indians who claim they suffered abuse at church-run residential schools. The Canadian government and one of the churches have agreed to split compensation costs for approximately 20% of the cases. Mike Fox reports from Montreal.
For most of the 20th century, Canadian Indian children were forcibly sent to residential schools, a misplaced effort at assimilation. Many suffered appalling physical and sexual abuse. All were alienated from their culture. Around 12,000 have brought lawsuits, but only a fraction have been settled. One major stumbling block is who should pay, the government that owned the schools or the churches that ran them. Now the Anglican Church has agreed to pay 30% of the claims against it, some $16 million, with the government paying the rest. But the Catholic Church, which faces most of the lawsuits, wants the government to take a bigger share. Most Canadian Indians are also unhappy. They'd have to drop all other legal action to get this money and believe they'd get more compensation through the courts. For NPR News, I'm Mike Fox in Montreal.
Heavy winds and rough seas along the northwest coast of Spain are helping to break up a 22-mile-long oil slick left by a tanker that broke up and sank yesterday. The tanker Prestige released about 800,000 gallons of oil as it sank, threatening beaches and fisheries along the coasts of Spain and Portugal. Spanish officials say the ship itself has apparently released no more oil since it sank in a part of the Atlantic that's more than 2 miles deep. Experts are hoping that the cold and water pressure at that depth will help solidify the oil and keep it from escaping. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Klein. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference. In theaters everywhere, Friday.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sekou Sundiata, is a poet, performer, and one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. Greg Tate wrote in The Village Voice, Sundiata is to contemporary African-American poetry what Marvin Gaye was to modern soul. Sundiata has a new one-man show about the period he had kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. Toward the end of 1999, after his transplant, he was on the way to his comeback performance, driving through the snow in New England, when his car slid off the road and he broke his neck. He spent the following year recovering from surgery. Fortunately, he has no paralysis or disability. He says his show is a personal look at the world from a forced withdrawal, an exile from the self he had come to know. His new show is called Blessing the Boats. The title is taken from a poem by Lucille Clifton, who also had a kidney transplant. Blessing the Boats premieres in New York this Friday at Aaron Davis Hall and will tour to several cities next year. Sekou Sundiata, welcome back to Fresh Air. Can you perform a short excerpt from your new piece?
Sure. This is from a section called The Part That Hurts. Here I am. A middle-aged brother with the shakes who can't stay awake, who has to hold on to the wall because his head is spinning like a gyroscope. A poet who can't make poems because there's too much distance between his mind and his body. And anyway, his mind is so slow and confused that ideas just bounce around and reverberate like a sound effect. Where's my witty? Where's my sovereignty? And most of all, where the hell is my cool? I was no longer the self I thought myself to be. How do you just wake up one day and not be who you think you are? I'll tell you how. The body is a low-down, dirty sneak. It remembers every physical or psychological insult it ever suffered. And each insult leaves a scar. And that scar is a map to the insult that just lays in the cut like a memorial. And should you delete it from your memory, your body will retrieve the data and bring it back up just when you're trying to go to sleep. Or just when somebody tells you that you're cute. Or just when you tell yourself how cool you are. Here comes the big payback. Your body will break you down. It will make you beg. It will make you change your priorities. For example, I was surprised to find out the size of the kidney. The kidney's job is to regulate a delicate balance of chemicals and minerals and water in the body. They clean the blood and regulate blood pressure. Big job, big organs. Simple as that. But most kidneys are the size of a small fist. And they're located in the back, off to the side. I had taken it for granted that the most important part of the body was located front and center. This is what I mean about the body being a sneak. It'll let you believe things like that until it's ready to tell you the truth. It ain't the heart, or the lungs, or the brain. The biggest, most important part of the body is the part that hurts.
That's Sekou Sundiata performing an excerpt of his new theater piece, Blessing the Boats. Sekou Sundiata, I really like this piece a lot. Why did you want to do a performance about your period of medical crisis?
Well, you know, first of all, in writing this piece, it is written in a way that is very different from the way I write. I don't write in a really personal way or an obviously autobiographical way. The first thing that drove me to write about this was my experience of going on dialysis and needing a transplant. I was on the transplant waiting list, which, you know, can be anywhere from 2 years to 5 years or more for some people. And during that period of time, five of my friends came forward and volunteered to be donors, to donate a kidney. And, you know, we went through the whole process of tissue typing and blood testing and all of that. And four out of the five people were found to be a match. It's very unusual, very rare, especially for people who are not related. And, you know, I was moved by that personally. And, you know, to me, it was a story that it just had so many implications to it in terms of what I call grace. The idea that for me, I couldn't have done anything to really earn anybody's kidney. Yet here were these people coming forward, volunteering to put their lives in jeopardy to save mine, essentially. So I was really driven by that, that this to me was just some unearned grace that is an always compelling story.
This is a very different kind of story for you in several ways. As you say, your things aren't often personal in that sense. And also, a lot of your stories are about somebody who's very mythic in a way, very cool or very revolutionary or very much about romantic love or risk-taking. You're writing sometimes about being African-American in America and what that means. And this is about being vulnerable.
Yeah, no question. The experience of having what's called end-stage renal disease and not knowing for quite some time, I'm talking about 3 years or more, 3-4 years, really what was wrong, you know, thinking that the symptoms sometimes can be some of anything. You know, there's a cluster of symptoms that can relate to a number of different things, and they're easy to excuse, especially if you're living a very busy and active life, which is what I was doing at the time. I felt by the time I was diagnosed with having renal failure, it was a new way of thinking about myself and a new way of thinking about my body. You know, I grew up being very active, being a amateur athlete, running, playing sports, and all of those things. And all of a sudden, my body would not do what I wanted it to do, you know, when I wanted it to do it. So it was a whole new way of being vulnerable.
How did you know something was wrong?
That's a good question. The things I felt was fatigue, tiredness, I was yawning all the time, frequent urination, those kinds of things. And frankly, you know, at the time I was very busy. I was touring with a show around the country, and I thought these things were due to being just tired and worn out, to traveling so much. You know, at one point in the piece, I talk about, you know, being in cheap hotels, lousy venues, breathing recycled airplane air, all of these things, you know, that we generally talk about when we get a general, being generally run down, which is how I felt. But what I noticed is that other people would feel the same way. So, I would say, well, you know, everybody I know is tired and run down. But they would recover. You know, they would rest for a week, 2 days, whatever, and recover. I could never recover. So it was almost as if there was this long-running flu that was trapped in my system. That was the first clue. The event that triggered it is I was having breakfast with a couple of friends in a restaurant one morning, and they told me that my face had broken out. I had these tiny bumps all over my face. We finished breakfast, and I went straight to the doctor, and, you know, the doctor examined me, and I did it, gave him a urine test. And he called me the next day to say that there was something in the test that indicated my kidney function wasn't right. So I went to see a kidney specialist, a nephrologist. That's when I found out that at that point, my kidneys were at 50%.
What was your initial way of dealing with being sick? Did you push yourself? Did you become more self-protective?
No, not really. My kidney disease, we suspect, was brought about by hypertension, probably long-term undiagnosed high blood pressure. And when I got that diagnosis from the urine test and I saw the nephrologist, basically I began blood pressure, hypertension medication. And so I was really trying to really stay with that. And then I started exercising and eating better and doing those kinds of things. But after about 6 months, I really, like many people, I had an aversion to the idea of having to take a pill every day. So I started slacking off. I'd take the medicine every now and then, and et cetera, et cetera. So I still wasn't convinced that that this was really as serious as it was. Even though the doctor said my kidneys were at 50%, there was the belief that any further deterioration could be halted once the blood pressure was brought under control, and that, you know, I could live a life at 50% kidney function.
So did people start reacting to you differently once you became weaker?
No, I didn't really notice a difference then. I noticed a difference actually after the transplant. People pretty much reacted the same to me even when I was on dialysis. I think that had to do with the form of dialysis that I was on, which is called peritoneal dialysis, meaning I didn't have to go to a hemodialysis center every week. It's something I did myself. So I maintained a lot of my strength, and I looked, actually, I had more vitality, even in the way I look, than before I went on dialysis. Some of my health returned. So there wasn't much of a reaction there, but once I had the transplant, I guess people are very suspicious about organ transplantation and disease and all of those things. So, you know, people I see even now who look at me as if they're surprised I'm still alive. I'm still walking around, you know.
Right. Well, you were lucky to have people willing to donate their kidneys to you and to find one that was such a good mix, match, and to not reject it. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, people seeing me after the transplant, it kind of triggered something about their own mortality.
Sure.
You know? So I recognize that some people backed away. You know, some people kind of lost contact. And it's a sense, it's very difficult to put my finger on it because nobody ever says this outright. But for some people, not all by any means, but for some people, there was a sense that they had given up on me in some way.
Given up on you, why?
Just that, well, that, you know, the end was near for me. You know?
I see, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, just a way of writing you off.
Well, that's kind of spooky, isn't it? Spooky
yeah,
to
it
you?
Is.
Yeah,
it is. But funny at the same time because, you know, I mean, I'm still here.
Yeah, thank goodness. My guest is poet Sekou Sundiata. His new one-man show, Blessing the Boats, premieres Friday in Manhattan. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sekou Sundiata. He's a poet and performance artist, writer. He has a new theater piece called Blessing the Boats, which is about getting a kidney transplant in the period of sickness that preceded it. There are two ways of getting a new kidney if you have kidney disease. One is to get a kidney from somebody who has just died, who was an organ donor. And the other is to get the kidney from somebody who you know, who is willing to undergo surgery and donate one of their kidneys to you. You took that second route. Did you think you were initially going to go the other route of getting it from an anonymous organ donor?
Yeah, I was on the transplant list, and I was on the list for about a year and a half, and I had no intention of asking anyone for a kidney. That was another part of it. I just couldn't imagine asking someone to give me a kidney. In fact, the nurses who looked after me when I was on peritoneal dialysis told me that I was the first patient they had who never asked them for a kidney. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that somebody would just ask, especially essentially a stranger, for a kidney. So in my mind, it was settled that I would be on the list until I got that call saying that, you know, we have a kidney for you, come to the hospital. But a couple of my friends said just at first casually that, yeah, I would give you a kidney. And, you know, I kind of just said thank you at first. But, yeah, it was, they mentioned it more than one time and wanted to talk about it seriously and wanted to know what it would take. And then finally it sank in. And, you know, I realized that, you know, these people were serious and they would really go through with the testing. And if they were a match, would donate, you know, donate their kidney. And, you know, again, these are unrelated. These are friends. These are not blood relatives.
So who are the people who made the offer?
Well, one is the woman that I love. I call Kazi, and she appears in the piece. The others are friends, you know, just two people were friends of hers who became friends of mine, you know, the longer we knew each other. One person is a long-term friend that I've known. Her name is Sydney. I've known her for about 20, 25 years. The other two people were two men named Bill and Claude. And then my close friend and manager, Katia Stitt, turned out to be the one who was the match and turned out to be my... Actually, they were all matches, but she turned out to be the donor.
Why her? Why not the other people?
Well, since four out of five people matched, we had discussions about it. Basically, over dinner, we would go out and have these great...
For all of you, the whole group?
Yeah, we would call them transplant dinners. We have these great dinners with great food and, you know, wine and laughter and everything, and we would talk about the transplant. And finally, we all went to get tested together. And when the results came in, we had another meeting to talk about what to do since, you know, all these people matched. And basically, they ranked themselves. They decided that Kazi, who was the only one with a child, would be fourth because she had a child, and there was some concern about that. Claude, who had some medical issues of his own going on, was ranked third. And then Bill, who was in good health and older than the rest, came in second. And Katia, who was in good health, the youngest, volunteered to be first. And then everyone else volunteered to be backup donors in case anything went wrong for any of us. You know, and to me, that was just remarkable. And whenever I would tell people this story, even before the transplant and after the transplant, whoever I tell that story to was really just moved by it. And so I thought that, you know, there's something in this story that is just beyond me. It's great, much, much greater than me. And it does speak to ideas about love and friendship, but also just about unearned grace.
I think it's interesting that your friends ranked themselves and took you out of the equation.
Yeah.
You know, no, that way the onus wasn't on you to decide who gave up the kidney. That must have been a great relief to have that decision taken out of your hands.
Absolutely. I mean, even at one point, before we got to that point when we were having a dinner with, I think there were three of us together, we were talking about the transplant and someone being a donor. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if I really want to do that, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember Claude said, well, you know, it's really not up to you. You know, if it's meant for you to have this kidney and you have people here who are willing to give it to you, you're going to have this kidney, you know. So the whole time, you know, I felt I was, you know, of course, operating under my own steam and under my own will. But I also feel that there was something else at work there.
Yeah, I know if it was me, if somebody said, you know, and I'd be willing to give you my kidney. I know I might think it's a kind of like, let's do lunch type of thing where,
right.
where the offer is made because everybody knows no one can really take you up on it. You know? So it must seem like a real impossibility of repaying such a debt. You know, what can you do that measures up to somebody giving you their kidney?
I don't think you can do anything. You know, I really don't. I asked each of them, and especially Katia, since she ended up being a donor, you know, what can I do? You know, what could I possibly do? And, you know, being the people they are, everyone said, well, you know, just get healthy, get well, et cetera, those kinds of things. In my own mind, I thought that, you know, as a writer and a storyteller, I thought maybe what I could do is tell this story. You know, I've talked about this before. I come out of a tradition of testifying and witnessing, whether that was in the church or, you know, in literature or whatever. And that the idea that in these testimonies that there is great value in these stories. And sometimes you can't really see what the value is, you know, at the time that you're doing it or telling it, but you sense that there's some great value in the story. So if anything, I mean, I don't think of it as repaying a debt because I don't think that can be done, you know, but it is what I have to offer. I've been given this story, and I think that it may be useful.
How has your relationship changed with Katia, who gave you the kidney? Is she still your manager?
Yeah, she is. She is. And we joke about, you know, this, about the donor. You know, she'll ask me how our kidney is doing. And, you know, at one point, one of the transplant coordinators told us when we were being evaluated for the transplant, that she had had reports from kidney recipients that they think they take on some of the characteristics of their donors, you know. And in the first 6 months or so after I got out of the hospital from the transplant, I would cry at the drop of a hat. I mean, just, you know, I mean, it would be a beautiful day and I would cry. The wind would be beautiful, I would cry. Or anything, you know, something on, watching a soap opera, I would cry. And Katia is kind of quick, close to her emotions like that. So I would joke with, I'd call up when I started crying and tell her kidney had me crying. And, you know, so it's something that we share, an experience that we share between us. And I feel, I don't know if I feel closer now than before, because we were very close, very close then.
Now, you know, when you have any kind of organ transplant, you have to worry about autoimmune problems. The immune system often attacks a transplanted organ, thinking right. that it's an invading foreign body that needs to be killed. And there's the medical explanation of that, but it also can take on great, like, metaphoric value, the idea of the body attacking itself, or the body mm-hmm. turning on the precious organ that is saving your life. Did you think about that both in medical and also in, like, literary terms?
Well, you know, first of all, I had a very rough transplant year after I was released from the hospital. I think I was probably back in the operating room 6 or 7 times that year alone, difficulties with the kidney, with the transplant. So, I thought about that a great deal. And I was highly, highly compliant, that's the term they use, in terms of, you know, taking my medications, keeping my appointments and all this. You know, I really felt, that I wanted to be well, but there was this was such a gift from Katia to me that I felt that I had to have just the best and most attentive stewardship of this, you know, of this organ. So, you know, that was very prominent in my mind, especially in that first year. And then, you know, the idea that when you get an organ transplant, your immune system is suppressed. And so what would be a normal line of defense is intentionally weakened. So that was something else to get used to, because it wasn't just about possibility of rejecting an organ. It was the possibility of opportunistic infections, all of these things that I would never think twice about, getting a cold, you know, even really getting the flu or other kinds of things now became much larger and much more serious to think about, you know. So in terms of vulnerability, it just increased that sense of vulnerability, I don't know, tenfold, you know.
Sekou Sundiata will be back in the second half of the show. His new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, premieres in Manhattan on Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference. In theaters everywhere Friday. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of I, Richard by Elizabeth George, author of A Traitor to Memory. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with poet Sekou Sundiata about his kidney transplant in 1999 and the car accident soon after in which he broke his neck. And we meet the woman who gave him one of her kidneys, Katia Stitt, his friend and manager.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with poet and performer Sekou Sundiata. His new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, is about his recent kidney failure, dialysis, and transplant. While he was on the waiting list for a new kidney, with his life in jeopardy, several of his friends offered to donate a kidney. Now, you mentioned that your lover was one of the people on the list of that short list of people willing to give you a kidney when you needed the transplant. And you're lovers. You've been lovers for several years, but you're not married. And I'm wondering if being in the hospital and being really sick made you reconsider the idea of getting married. And I ask that for, like, all the practical kind of reasons, health insurance, visiting hours, mm-hmm. often like an official spouse is cut a lot of breaks in the hospital that the girlfriend or the boyfriend wouldn't be given, particularly if you don't know the doctors very well. Last will and testament kind of stuff. A lot of that stuff is sometimes a lot easier with a spouse than it is with a lover. If this isn't too personal, can you talk about thinking that through?
Well, what I can say about that is, you're absolutely right. It does make a difference under certain circumstances, whether you're married or not. And like many people who are not married, there are times when we become conveniently married.
Right.
For just those reasons, you know. And, you know, and at other times, some of the things you mentioned, you know, you don't have to be married to do. But I don't, you know, I didn't start thinking so much in terms of marriage. It's just thinking in terms of how deep the relationship became. You know, and I didn't necessarily formulate that in terms of marriage, but a deep kind of devotion and commitment that, frankly, I'd never known before. You know, and I had so much. I went through so many changes even before I got the transplant, but afterwards, it was a very difficult year. And basically, Kazi was my caretaker. You know, I mean, she just took care of me. And of course, she didn't bargain for any of this when she got involved with me. You know, this just happened. You know, and she also has a daughter who also was very, you know, she's 11 now, but she was, of course, you know, 5 or 6 at the time, who also took on a caretaking role. You know, mm-hmm. So what I can say is, in this case, you know, the relationship really deepened in terms of commitment and devotion.
Katia, your manager, who donated your kidney,
mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if she was white or African-American.
African-American. And, I mean, it's interesting that you would ask that because
I felt uncomfortable asking. Is that a bad question to ask?
No. I think it's a good question, and for a number of reasons. One is that, first of all, it gives me an opportunity to say what I'm about to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that is that, you know, I really did think, as I suspect many people who don't know anything about the world of transplantation, that transplants needed to be race, that it was better if they were race specific and gender specific. You know, in other words, I thought that, you know, that it would be a real difficulty for a black person to be a donor to a white person, and or for a man to a woman, or all of those things. And I guess those are ideas that I import from the social realm, you know. That's not the case. I mean, and I met adults my age or in and around my age who had what they call pediatric kidneys, you know, kidneys from really very young children, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, apparently that's not an issue preventing transplantation, although race does play a part in certain ways. When I was in those 3 weeks when I was in the hospital for the transplant, one of the difficulties I had is my immune system was resisting being suppressed by the medication they gave me. And I was on the highest dosage of one of the immunosuppressant drugs, but my body was not absorbing it. And the doctor told me that African Americans have the hardest immune system to suppress, which I found interesting. In fact, I had something about that in one of the earlier versions of the script, you know. And to me, that was an interesting thing, just personally, but also in a historical, as a writer, I took a great interest in that, thinking about why that would be and how maybe, why did that evolve in that way? Why did African Americans evolve in that way? And what connections that may have had to the stress of slavery and Middle Passage and all of those things. So I think that that is the question you ask is a valid and very worthwhile question. I think people thinking about donation have those questions.
My guest is poet Sekou Sundiata. His new one-man show, Blessing the Boats, is about his experiences with kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. We'll meet his friend who donated her kidney after a break. This is Fresh Air. After hearing poet Sekou Sundiata talk about his kidney transplant, we wanted to meet the woman who donated her kidney. So before we hear more from Sundiata, we're going to talk with his good friend and manager, Katia Stitt. Stitt's clients have included Entezaki Shange, Lester Bowie, Defunct, and Sweet Honey in the Rock. She directs the Smithsonian Institution's Jazz Oral History Program, and she's the daughter of jazz saxophonist Sonny Stitt. Katia Stitt had known Sundiata for only 2 years when she offered her kidney. Not long after her surgery, she met her husband, Sven. They now have an 18-month-old daughter. Katia told me more about the transplant dinners, the gatherings between Sundiata and his friends who had offered to be organ donors. She said after four of the friends found they had the right blood type for donation, the tone of the dinners changed.
That's when you felt the tension of like, okay, what are we going to do here? Who is really going to... I think we all were willing to step up to the plate, but who was really, okay, going to take the plunge? And I think somehow I said, well, I really don't mind doing it. And I also think at that time in my life, my lifestyle probably lended itself to doing it because I was single, because I wasn't a mother yet, because I was in a very good place with my business and working for myself. I had other clients, but I had other clients that knew of Sekou, knew that this might be a possibility, and were all being very supportive. So it was just, you know, the conditions were right. And I can't remember how we didn't, you know, draw straws or something like this, but there was a moment when we said, okay, Katia will do it, and then Bill will be her backup. So we actually have a pack that if something happened to my remaining kidney, then Bill would donate to me. So that's how we went into it. And then whomever was the donor would also be taken care of by the other three.
And so they took care of you.
Yeah, very well. Very well, yeah.
What was the process of recovery like?
It was not very difficult, believe it or not. I mean, there are sometimes complications for some donors, but I think that's very rare. For me, it was very easy. I had done a lot of preparing beforehand. I had done a lot of, I do a lot of fasting and cleansing, and I'd done a lot of, I do a lot of juicing anyway, but I had done a juice fast right before, and I kind of had all my homeopathic things I needed and just had read an awful lot, so I was very educated going into the process, so I knew what to expect. Mm-hmm. There was a funny moment after, a few days after the operation, I was still on the morphine from the pain, for the pain, and I had gone to visit Sekou. Sekou and I were on opposite ends of the same wing, and they kept kind of donors on one side and those... We were on recipients on the other for some strange reason. But I went to visit him. I was sitting in the chair talking to him. And then I started nodding off periodically. And Sekou kept laughing at me because I'd wake up and I'd start talking again as if I'd never been to sleep. And I was like, what is so funny? And, you know, he explained it to me. But other than that, actually, my reaction to the morphine, I was fine. I mean, it took me about 3 weeks. I was a week in the hospital. And then I spent 2 more weeks in New York recovering with friends. The biggest thing for me was that I was tired mm-hmm. for about a month or so, just really tired. Like, I had to sleep, and that went on for about a month. And then after that, I was fine. Yeah.
How long after you donated the kidney did you become pregnant with your daughter?
Let's see. The donation was January of 99. I was pregnant in September of 2000. And actually, you know, if I can just say, I thought of that as the greatest, well, my daughter, becoming pregnant with my daughter, and actually my union with Sven. I thought of those as kind of gifts that I received for giving my kidney to Sekou, because I really do believe that. I felt like giving the kidney to Sekou was a walk of faith, you know, and of love. You know, you don't do something like that for someone if you don't love them or love humanity. You know, you can do it for someone you don't know, but then you have a deep love for humanity. And I just knew that when you do something like that, you're bound to get rewarded, you know, and not in a physical, material way that we think of reward. I mean on a metaphysical, spiritual, on the subtle level, you're bound to be rewarded. And Johanna and Sven are definitely that.
So you said that you think, you know, meeting your husband mm-hmm. and having your daughter were almost like gifts
yeah.
in return for donating the kidney. How'd you meet your husband?
Sven and I met actually about 8 years ago now. We used to kind of hang out at this alternative warehouse where they made environmental films and, you know, we're going to change the world and that kind of deal. But we were friends. And then he called while I was recuperating in New York to see how I was doing. A mutual friend of ours said, hey, Katia did this. He hadn't seen me in years. And he said, Katia did this. And I don't have time to call her, but here's her number. And Sven said, yeah, I'm going to call her. That's amazing. And he did call me a few times to see how I was. And then when I came back to D.C., he actually called again to see how I was doing. And we started just going out. You know, he said, oh, you want to get together and go rollerblading or hiking or something? And one thing led to another. So, you know, it kind of was tied into the transplant after all, because he probably wouldn't have even thought of me, I don't think, had a friend of ours reminded him or told him that I had done this. And he said, oh, yeah. You know, we were always friendly, and we run into each other in the city and, you know, say, how are you doing? How are things? But that was the extent of it. And, you know, here he is, like the perfect match, so to speak.
That's so great.
It was. It was really nice.
How big is the scar?
Oh, pretty big. Do you want to see now?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Do you want to see?
Yeah.
It's right here. Can you?
Is it there? I can see it. Yeah, it's on your right side, and it you're very skinny, I should say, but it kind of covers the side of like the midsection.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I guess it looks like it's probably 8 or 9 inches
uh-huh.
long.
Uh huh. Yeah. But it looks like it healed well.
It did heal well. In fact, our surgeon,
yeah.
he said, I'll try to do it so you can still wear a bikini. And I was like, yeah, I'm really worried about that. If I were worried about that, I wouldn't give my kidney, you know.
But that's the thing. People always are worried about scars, but this is probably a scar that you're really proud to have.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do wear a bikini in the summer, but I don't talk about it much. You know, sometimes people look or they're very curious or they ask even, and I'll tell them then. I guess in some ways it might be a badge of some, I don't want to say a badge of honor, but, you know, of something that we've been through. Sekou and I have been through many things together, but this is something that will always be there, you know. And when I'm 90, I can look at the scar, even without Sekou, you know, if I don't have him in my life, and say, well, we had a good friendship. And I really do feel like we'll be friends forever. We might not always work together, but we will be friends forever.
Katia Stitt donated a kidney to poet Sekou Sundiata. She's his close friend and manager. Before we get back to our interview with Sundiata, let's hear a track from his 1997 CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams. This is his poem, Shout Out.
Nia Imani Kujajakalia. Here's to the best words in the right place at the perfect time, to the human mind blown up and refined. To long conversations and the philosophical ramifications of a beautiful day. To the 12 steppers at the 13th step, may they never forget the first step. To the increase, to the decrease, to the do, to the do, to the did, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the done, done. To the lonely, to the brokenhearted, to the new blue haiku. Here's to all or nothing at all. Here's to the sick and the shut in. Here's to the was you been, to the is you in, to us deep and deep, to us down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. To the crazy, the lazy, the bored, the ignored, the beginners, the sinners, the losers, the winners, to the smooth and the cool, and even to the fools. Here's to your ex-best friend. To the rule benders and the repeat offenders. To the lovers and the troublers, the engaging, the enraging, to the healers and the feelers and the fixers and the tricksters, to a star falling through a dream, to a dream when you know what it means. To the bottom, to the root, to the base, boom, to the drum. Here's to the was you've been, to the is you in, to what's deep and deep, to what's down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to somebody within the sound of your voice this morning. Here's to somebody who can't be within the sound of your voice tonight. To a low cholesterol pig sandwich smothered in swine without the pork. To a light buzz in your head and a soundtrack in your mind going on and on and on and on and on like a good time. Here's to promises that break by themselves. Here's to the breaks with great promise. To people who don't wait in the car when you tell them to wait in the car. Here's to what you forgot and who you forgot. Here's to the unforgettable. Here's to the was you been, to the is you in, to what's deep and deep, to what's down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the hip hoppers, the don't stoppers, heads nodding in the digital glow.
Let's get back to our interview with poet Sekou Sundiata. His new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, is about his kidney failure, dialysis, and kidney transplant. You were preparing for a comeback concert in New England, and you were driving to this concert, you know, after you had gotten healthy enough following your kidney transplant to start performing again. You're driving in a snowstorm through New England to get to this comeback concert. And you were in a car accident and broke your neck in the car accident. And from my understanding, you nearly died in that accident. You were trapped in the car for a couple of hours. What was going through your mind when you were in that car with a broken neck after having just gotten through this horrible period of kidney failure, kidney transplant, post-kidney transplant surgeries, finally recover, and then you're in this horrible accident?
Well, my first thought, I mean, even as the car was sliding, you know, in the snow, was how absurd this was. You know, it just seemed stupid to me. First of all, this happened in January of 2000. I had my last surgery related to the transplant in December. I don't even know if it was a full month before the accident. So I was still in a sense recuperating from that. So I thought that was, you know, I was putting that behind me when this whole thing happened. And I remember thinking as the car was sliding off the highway that I just couldn't believe it could all come down to this. You know, it just seemed like such an absurd and silly thing, you know, to happen. And then also, I have to tell you this, you know, I think that there's no question that my life was in danger. I didn't know that my neck was broken while I was there, you know, upside down in the snow. And I didn't think anybody could see that I'd gone off the road. But I never felt that I was going to die. You know, I never felt that was it. And I don't know, there's no physical evidence to support that idea because it was a blinding snowstorm. I dropped down a slope. You could not see me from the highway. And I couldn't even hear the car, the traffic on the highway passing by. So I had no real evidence to support that. It was just a blind faith that I had that somehow this was not it. At the same time, I'd never been so alone and isolated in my life. And I don't think I never knew things could be that quiet either. And then this woman shows up, kneeling beside the car in the storm, and she has a cell phone. And she starts talking to me, and she calls 911, and, you know, she gets all of that going. And by the time the fire department arrives, this woman is gone. I never see her again. I don't know her name or any of that, but she's just gone. And from at that point on, you know, the fire department has it, and they cut me out and all of that.
Did you have any idea before all this happened to you that people could be so good, so decent?
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, and really, it's a case of knowing something for quite some time, and then something happens, and you get to know it at an even deeper and more profound level. I've been fortunate, in my life to just been helped and assisted by so many people, both people I've seen and then people I haven't seen, but I know that, you know, people have helped me in various ways, and you know, I've had just an example of many examples of this kind of goodness. Having said that, it didn't diminish in any way the fact that this was seemingly out of the blue, you know, and very mysterious. I mean, she showed up and then she was gone, you know. But, you know, I think that that's fundamental in the human heart, you know. And I think it's probably more common than we may perceive on a day-to-day basis.
It's really lucky and amazing that after breaking your neck, you didn't end up paralyzed or partially paralyzed. You got your full movement back, right?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I started while I was trapped in the car. First thing I did was wiggle my toes and, you know, try and wiggle my fingers to see if I had function. Yeah, I was very, very fortunate.
So how long did it take you to recover from that?
Well, quite some time. At first, the doctor said I wouldn't need surgery, actually. You know, I had a huge brace on my neck, and they thought that if I wore that for 12 weeks that I would be fine. But it started to deteriorate, so I ended up having spinal fusion surgery. And the recovery time there, I think, was about maybe 8 weeks. But then in the midst of all that, I caught pneumonia, I think, as a result of the surgery. So it ended up being about, I don't know, 6 months, 7 months.
How would you describe your physical condition now?
Now I'm feeling good. I'm still at the point, though, where I'm still conditioning my body. My body is still very much out of condition. From the transplant alone, from the time I went into the hospital for the transplant and the time that I came out, about 3 weeks, I lost about 55, 60 pounds. And because I was in and out of the hospital so much that year, you know, I kept losing weight and gaining a little weight here and there. And so altogether, it's my conditioning, my physical conditioning is not where I would like it to be. So I've been working on that, you know, physical therapy. And, you know, after the first of the year, I'll be at least at the level where I can do some more serious training, perhaps with a personal trainer. My health overall is very good. I feel fine. You know, I'm doing all of the things I did before. So I'm doing well.
My guest is poet Seiko Sundiata. His new one-man show, Blessing the Boats, premieres Friday in Manhattan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with poet Seiko Sundiata. His new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, is about being physically transformed. He had kidney failure and a kidney transplant. Just as he was well enough to start performing again, he was in a car accident in the snow and broke his neck. He recovered from the accident without paralysis or disability. In the first interview that you did with us on Fresh Air, you know, we were talking about performing, and you said something like, you know, the spotlight is the power spot in American culture. Like when you're on stage in front of the microphone, that's the power spot where everybody is like more, they have more charisma, they're more important, they're more sexy than anything in actual real life.
Mm-hmm.
So what's it like to be in that power spot now on stage, but in a more like vulnerable condition? Not only feeling more vulnerable, but talking about that.
Well, you know, first of all, it still has all the attachments of power to me, you know. Power and power that really, I think, stems from a kind of magic, you know, that it is set aside from normal everyday life. And, you know, it is special in that way. I think now that it's about expression while I'm there, but I also feel just a sense of you know, an overwhelming sense of gratitude to be able to be in that spotlight, in the sense that here I am doing my work, You know, that's what I consider to be an important part of my work, the writing, you know, which I do essentially alone, and then this public aspect of it is something that gives me great joy and fulfillment, aside from whatever value I may think it may have out in the world. Personally, I discovered, I don't know, when I was a child, that whenever I can go into my imagination and whatever I can dig up there and then bring out, you know, it's something that gave me great joy and satisfaction, you know. And so to be able to do that again and to feel that, to feel healthy and to be able to do that again is a wonderful thing.
Seiko, would you be willing to perform another short excerpt from your show, Blessing the Boats?
Sure. This is a poem that comes early in the piece. And it is, every time I went into the operating room and I started going in, when I was under anesthesia, I'd always hear this music. I mean, really beautiful music. It wasn't the same music all the time, but it was just be beautiful, rapturous music. And it was so beautiful and so present that whenever I came out of anesthesia, I was sure everybody else could hear it. So I'd ask, you know, the doctors and the nurses, and nobody ever heard this music. And in most cases, they would say they didn't even play music in the operating room at the time. So this comes out of that. This poem comes out of that experience. Somewhere deep and under anesthesia, the valves of a human heart open and close, and the black scat syllables of sacred science come pouring onto a clean page turning over in my mind. The blues bat their eyes and rustle their wings. A double reed vibrates in a pure light that means all things are possible. A bow draws out a round tone across the waist of a bass. It could be the devil's note, the way it cuts through the wood and wind, bending the sound right side up, harmonizing the underworld. Whoever said the music goes into the air and then it's gone was wrong. It goes below the flesh and above the grave, where I am flat as a mesa, open as the great gorge beneath the Taos sky. I try to remember the notes by humming, but humming burns the music out of memory.
Seiko Sundiata's new theater piece, Blessing the Boats, premieres Friday and runs through the weekend at Aaron Davis Hall on the campus of City College in Manhattan. Next year, he'll take a show on the road. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving Lutherans, their families, and communities with financial strategies and customer-focused service. Online at thrivent.com. From Nonesuch Records and Travelogue, the new album by Joni Mitchell, a 2-CD set featuring new recordings of 22 songs spanning her entire career, accompanied by full orchestra, available at Barnes & Noble. And by Universal Pictures, presenting The Emperor's Club, starring Kevin Kline. In every person's life, there is someone who makes all the difference. In theaters everywhere Friday. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bob Woodward about his new book, Bush at War, a behind-the-scenes look at the Bush administration after September 11th. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.